DW.
Fatma Kuba lies on a hospital bed in Hadja in Yemen's west. Her arms are thinner than a chair leg. Her large, tired eyes look out from her gaunt face. She almost looks like an old woman, but Fatma is only 12 years old. When she was hospitalised, she weighed just 10 kilograms, or 22 pounds. Usually, she'd be playing with her friends outside or going to school. Instead, Dr. Makia Al-Aslami is trying to save her from dying of starvation.
Her body has already used up all its fat reserves and has only left skin and bones behind. We'll have to treat Fatma for at least a month before she can even start to heal slowly.
Fatma's sister is devastated.
No one takes pity on us. No one is helping us. We're starving here and no one cares. We have no future. Only when a relative came and saw how Fatma was suffering and how devastated we were, did she get taken to the hospital, and he paid all of her bills.
The United Nations estimates that around 10 million Yemenis are on the brink of starvation. 4 out of 5 people need emergency relief. The German NGO Welthungerhilfe, which means World Hunger Aid in English, says 2 million children younger than 5 are currently malnourished. But these numbers are only half the story. What's really happening on the ground in Yemen is beyond our imagination. It's a silent tragedy. No one is being jolted into action by the wave of refugees from Yemen because the country is sealed off for political as well as geographical reasons. That's why the suffering in this impoverished country isn't an issue on Europe's agenda. It's rarely made clear what the abstract words "greatest humanitarian crisis in the world" actually mean for daily life in Yemen. Every day, people there have to decide over life and death. They have to decide, for example, whether to use the little money they have to pay for transport to take their dying child to the next hospital, or whether they should use the money to buy bread so that the rest of the family has a chance of survival.
I was even talking to some women the other day when we were out in the valley, and they were in a very remote area and they were getting water from a stream to give to their children.
That's Claire Manera. She was working for the aid organisation Doctors Without Borders in northwestern Yemen 1.5 years ago when the cholera epidemic reached its height.
And we stopped and said to them, but you know that this water you can't drink, it's infected with cholera and it's basically poison. And the women said, yes, we know, but we have no choice.
It was the only water available, so their choice was to either die from thirst or from cholera.
Most of Yemenis, they have to make this hard decision every day.
Hafez al-Bukhari is from Yemen, but he now lives in Cairo. He leads the Yemen Polling Center, an independent research institute.
Most of families already, use all their savings because they were thinking that this war might last for 2-3 months, and they think that it might be a year, and then, okay, another year. So now we are in the fourth year, and the war have not ended, but all their resources and savings drained.
There's hardly any work, and the economy has collapsed.
You see in their faces that they don't have, financial resources to survive, because most of people are not working, or they don't receive salaries. You see this in their faces, and they just don't know who is responsible of this.
The question of who's responsible will be met with different answers, depending on who you ask. King Salman of Saudi Arabia is certain who's to blame: the Houthi militias that launched an insurgency in northern Yemen. The Houthi rebels are terrorists supported by Iran, the monarch recently said at a conference, adding that the rebels and Iran were responsible for the situation in Yemen. Classifying sides as good or evil is a dangerous simplification, but it supports the kingdom's stance. Saudi Arabia is fighting a bloody war in Yemen, but according to them, they're fighting on the side of the good guys. On the evening of March 25, 2015, Adel al-Jubayr appeared before the press in Washington. At that time, he was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States.
The operations began approximately 7 o'clock Washington time, East Coast time, PM, yes. This decision did not come lightly. We will do whatever it takes in order to protect the legitimate government of Yemen from falling and from facing any dangers from an outside militia. We must do everything we can to protect the people of Yemen and to protect the legitimate government of Yemen.
When he made that statement, it was already early morning in Yemen. At around 2 a.m. local time, fighter jets from a Saudi-led military coalition started to bomb targets in parts of the country held by Houthi militants. The attacks were supported by the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar. After that point, the propaganda machine in Saudi Arabia shifted up a gear. The operation in Yemen is called Decisive Storm, maybe because it sounds a bit like Operation Desert Storm, the name the US gave to its intervention in Iraq in 1991. Saudi Arabian TV began broadcasting images of the new dynamic Minister of Defense, Mohammed bin Salman, watching the bombings from the operation room, as if the Saudis wanted to say, "We don't just talk, we act," just like the Americans did with their military interventions. 2 years later, the defense minister was appointed crown prince. The Saudi-led airstrikes not only hit Houthi positions, they also destroyed markets, residential buildings, hospitals, waterworks, and wedding parties. They wiped out whole families. International observers estimate that more than 10,000 people have died since the start of the military operation, among them thousands of civilians. Saudi Arabia claims to protect the internationally recognised government led by President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. He fled in September 2014 when Houthi rebels overran the Yemeni capital Sana'a. But basically, the kingdom is fighting a proxy war against Iran. It considers the Shia Houthis a weapon with which Iran wants to remap its southern border with Saudi Arabia. The Sunni kingdom feels threatened by the Shia crescent. To its north, the Iraqi government is dominated by Shias and is also protected by Iran. During the Syrian conflict, Iran and Russia prevented the fall of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And in Lebanon, the Shia Hezbollah is strong and also supported by Iran. But the war is more than a regional conflict over power between Shia and Sunni Muslims. That alone wouldn't explain how the chaos in Yemen unfolded and how little that has to do with religion. The situation gets more complex and confusing the closer one looks at it.
It gets more complicated the more you look at everyday life.
Mareike Transfeld works at the Free University in Berlin and has spent years doing research in Yemen. She lived there for almost a decade, and although she's not there right now, she explained her take on the conflict via Skype. She says the fact that the Houthi militants were able to gain control of the capital and western parts of the country in 2014 has little to do with Iran. According to many Yemenis, the real reason was the failure of the Hadi government.
The einzigen Akteure, die sich wirklich aktiv gegen die Houthis gestellt haben, waren...
The only stakeholders to really take an active stance against the Houthi rebels were the Islam Party and the Yemeni Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters. Everybody else just stood there and watched. But the citizens in Sana'a, including those who moved to the capital from the north and the south, they were just curious.
Maybe some Yemenis believed the Houthis would be less corrupt than the Hadi government. Hafez al-Bukhari at the Yemen Polling Centre says he also witnessed the advance of the Houthi militia.
I saw in my eyes two small cars just go to the Ministry of Defence and control it easily because there were no persons in charge.
Hadi and his followers fled. Hadi became president in 2012 after Ali Abdullah Saleh was ousted in a popular uprising. After that, Saleh, a former Saudi ally, sided with the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels. It didn't seem important that the rebels were Shia Muslims. Al-Bukhari says the ethnic group actually belongs to a sub-branch of the Shia denomination.
No person was calling himself Shia in Yemen. They say, we are not Shia, we are Zaydis, which is like a wing from Shia, but it's more close to Sunnis than close to Shia.
During the 1960s, the Zaydi and also the Shia Houthi militias fought alongside Sunni Saudi Arabia against the Egyptian army.
In the street, you cannot notice them. There is no differences between Zaydis and Sunnis. And in the mosque, there is no Zaydi mosque, no Sunni mosque. All people pray together, live together, marriage from each other. And even you don't notice who's Zaydi, who's Sunni.
The current conflict started in 2004 in northwestern Yemen. People there began to challenge the government in Sana'a, which they felt was discriminating against them. Most of the agitators were from the Houthi tribes. The government accused the ethnic group of harbouring separatist aims and responded with a brutal crackdown. Hundreds of people ended up in prison. Tribal leader Houthi Hussein al-Houthi was murdered. In the following years, the Houthi movement established a rebel militia called Ansar Allah, which means the partisans of God. And it developed guerrilla tactics to fight against the government, similar to those used by Hezbollah in Lebanon. Here's rebel leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi addressing his followers in December 2009.
The guilty will pay for every crime committed against you. Every battle that we fight for you, we will name after one of our martyrs.
It was a local conflict that just kept escalating. Another sign the conflict was a domestic affair was the fact that the Houthi rebels only accepted help from Iran very late. The cooperation with Tehran began in 2011, but it only grew stronger in 2014. Al-Bukhari from the Yemen Polling Center says this is what they got from Iran.
Advisors, technical and political support, military support. Many weapons were captured or seen in the field that were coming from Iran. The support that they are given by Hezbollah is the main support that they get. It's mainly from Iran. It is politically, in the media, in the war, in the strategy and thinking it's Hezbollah.
The Lebanese militant organization also helps with public relations. But as far as weapons are concerned, the naval blockade by the Saudi-led military coalition has likely prevented most arms from getting into the country. It's not yet clear if the missiles fired by the Houthi rebels into the neighbouring kingdom came from older weapons stockpiles. Yemen specialist Mareike Transfeld doubts that the Houthis are just an extended arm of Tehran, as is often claimed. For a long time, they were a very local group, she says.
And that's what the Houthi rebels still are today. But it's also obvious that they increasingly feel part of that Iran, Lebanon, Syria, Bashar al-Assad nexus.
Syrien, Bashar al-Assad Achse versteht.
There are several reasons for this. Before 2011, the Saleh government brutally crushed the Houthi uprising instead of tackling the root causes behind it. And there's also the relentless war led by Saudi Arabia in Yemen that's pushing the Houthi rebels further into the arms of Tehran. Now the conflict has escalated into a fateful contest about religion on both sides. And it's accompanied by religious propaganda that's found fertile soil. For example, take this policeman. He's standing in front of the ruins of a building in Sana'a, where the Houthi militia is in control.
The people in this building were killed by Saudi missiles. Our leader, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, commanded us to go to jihad against the attackers, and we followed him with our bodies and souls.
At the same time, the Houthi rebels are becoming increasingly repressive, al-Bukhari says.
If you are a businessman known as rich person, you are under threat because they come to blackmail you to take some money of you. If you are a former officer, you are under threat because you have to fight with them or you will be in danger, they will arrest you. If you are a journalist, and you are not working with them, you are under threat. If you are a human rights activist and you are independent, so you have to report on the violations, you are under threat.
Activists are abducted, arrested, tortured, and even murdered. Here's Mareike Transfeld again.
The repressive rule of the Houthi rebels is really extreme in the Yemeni context. That's new in the country's history.
Meanwhile, the war continues, but it's reached a dead end. The Saudi-led coalition bombs positions held by Houthi militants, who in turn attack troops fighting for the Hadi government and its allies. In December, the rival parties signed a UN-brokered agreement in Stockholm. They agreed to a truce and the withdrawal of Houthi rebels from the port of Hodeidah to allow much-needed humanitarian aid to finally be unloaded and distributed throughout the country. But the truce didn't last, and the withdrawal didn't happen. Even the so-called efforts for mutual confidence building, like the exchange of prisoners, have stalled. In its mediation efforts, the UN is focusing on the hostility between the Houthi rebels and the Hadi government and their Saudi allies.
Issues that are dividing the country, that are threatening the country, and you have to pave the way for the future by resolving these issues. Because they were demanding issues.
According to Hafez Al-Bukhari, the UN efforts don't take the root causes of the conflict into account. The Houthi rebels, as well as other ethnic groups, had reasons to be frustrated. The devil is in the detail, and Al-Bukhari believes that's not reflected by the Stockholm Agreement. He thinks it'll fail. Mareike Transfeld agrees.
There is little that you can offer the Houthi rebels to make them agree to a compromise.
That's why the humanitarian crisis in Yemen won't end anytime soon. There are even fears the population is facing another cholera outbreak. The statistics support those concerns, says Waleed Al-Watiri at the Organization for Health Development. There are many new suspected cholera cases, he says. During Yemen's last cholera epidemic in 2017, some 1 million people were infected. Ultimately, it's the warring parties that cause epidemics and famines to break out. Meanwhile, people like this man in the war-torn port of Hodeidah long for nothing more than the Stockholm Agreement to be implemented.
If the Houthi rebels don't find a peaceful solution, the war will continue to scare and frighten us every day.
DW.